This is Raymond Massey. On the shores of Lake Erie, on a famous street called Euclid Avenue, the citizens of Cleveland, Ohio, maintain the nation's first municipal health museum. Just inside the front door of this museum is a tall rectangular box, not unlike a coin machine in shape and appearance, with a microphone attached. Place the microphone against the left side of your chest, and this, as we recorded it for you, is the sound that you will hear. The amplified sound of the beat of a human heart, 70 times a minute, 100,000 times a day, more than 36 million times a year. 2.5 billion heartbeats by the time you reach the age of 65.
Health Information Foundation and the National Broadcasting Company bring you the fourth in a special series of transcribed programs exploring the endless frontier of medical research. Our chapter today, Only One to a Customer. And here again is the distinguished American actor, Mr. Raymond Massey.
That machine we heard a moment ago recording the heartbeat in Cleveland's Health Museum symbolizes in a way a matter of deep civic concern in the Ohio City. For Cleveland, in the heart of America, is heart conscious. Cleveland reflects in its hospitals, in its laboratories, in its industry, the major assault that science is making on the number one killer among Americans today. Diseases of the coronary and circulatory system. Heart disease. City doing battle against heart trouble, if it approaches the problem intelligently, starts with this premise. The heart victim is not necessarily an economic liability. Many a man or woman with heart disease is nevertheless able to work. And that's why the city of Cleveland, through the cooperation of industry and the medical profession, has set up what it calls its Work Classification Center. Here it is that doctors, medical social workers, vocational counselors, attack the problem of heart disease in Cleveland's plants and industry, weighing medical history against aptitudes and the capacity to work. Let's eavesdrop on a typical interview as it was recorded in Cleveland's Work Classification Clinic.
You were out of work for about 6 months.
6.5 months.
What was the trouble? I mean, what was the problem?
All the things, asthma, coughing.
Were you pretty short of breath?
Short of breath, yes.
Uh-huh. And what kind of work did you do before you got sick?
Grinding.
That's pretty hard. And how many years of service did you have?
31 years. I got 33 now.
We found you had some blood pressure trouble. A lot of it was due to the sort of asthma and bronchitis.
A grinding machine, abrasives, high blood pressure. Not a good combination. Yet here's a man with a record of 32 years service. On a basis of the interview, the clinic director summed up this man's assets as an employee.
His excellent work attitude, his ability to work a full week, his interest in employment, and loyalty to the company.
How, then, is this work problem resolved? Our sufferer from high blood pressure is taken off the grinding machine, placed in charge of a tool crib. And here is the recorded testimony of his foreman.
All I can say is that he worked pretty nice on the job, took care of our tool crib all the time. And I would say that he can handle this job, that he's doing real good.
And is this man, with his heart condition, a safety hazard? The company's safety engineer doesn't think so.
His type of work is a tool crib attendant, as well within the prescribed physical capability limits recommended by the Work Classification Center of the Cleveland Heart Society. I think the risk is comparatively light.
What of the man himself? How does he feel about all this?
Now, what did you think of that examination you had over at the clinic and the way you were treated over there?
Oh, I think the examination was wonderful. It'd be rather good.
So the company retains a veteran employee. Society saves a useful member. And most important of all, a man who wants to work is able to work, is rescued from the discard, and keeps his self-respect. Yet all too often, heart disease is a medical problem in the dramatic, critical sense. Its impact strikes the patient down. There are three major fronts today in the unceasing war against this killer. Some doctors in Cleveland named them.
Acute rheumatic fever attacks primarily the younger individual and thus leads to permanent disability during the productive years of the individual's life.
Rheumatic fever, a major cause of heart disease. Then, too, there is this.
Roughly 10 million people in this country have cardiovascular disease. And much of this disease is caused by hypertension and its resultant arteriosclerosis.
In other words, high blood pressure and hardening of the arteries. Then,
coronary thrombosis, angina pectoris, is responsible for about one death out of every four adult men. It kills about 2.5 times as many people as does cancer.
The menace which last week led a physician in London to say, sadly, the king died of starvation of the heart. In all three of these areas, rheumatic fever, coronary disease, high blood pressure, we found men and women in Cleveland who were doing new, interesting, and exciting things. At University Hospital on the rolling campus at Western Reserve University, we met Dr. Claude Beck. He is a big man, large of frame, and yet, as so often happens, his capable-looking hands still don't suggest at first glance the delicate and sensitive skill of a brilliant surgeon. But he is a pioneer in a new surgical technique which the medical profession is already calling the Beck operation. By way of preface, Dr. Beck reminded us of a piece of elementary physiology.
The heart muscle is supplied by red blood through the coronary arteries.
Then he described a condition which frequently precedes attacks of coronary thrombosis.
As we grow older, these arteries may become blocked off, either partially or completely, and the heart then does not get enough red blood to perform its function.
In other words, pipeline, vital pipeline, leading into this pulsating mechanism become obstructed. Red blood can no longer course through coronary arteries, which are indispensable. Oh, wait. Are they indispensable? For centuries, ever since the days of Harvey, men had assumed so. Yet Dr. Beck is the kind of scientist who assumes nothing. With the open-minded curiosity of the investigator and with his intimate knowledge of the heart structure, he began to review to himself the circulatory process.
The red blood gets into the heart muscle through the coronary arteries. It then passes through the tiny capillary channels where it gives up its oxygen to the heart muscle cells. It then collects as blue blood into the veins. And these veins unite to form a very large vein on the back of the heart, which is called the coronary sinus.
And concerning this large vein at the back of the heart, Dr. Beck took note of a curious thing.
This vein is not essential to life. You can put a string around the vein, tie it off, and the heart will keep on beating. The venous blood, under this condition, gets out of the heart through other channels.
And then Dr. Beck had his inspiration. Thus tied off, thus, so to speak, taken out of circulation,
this vein now becomes a spare part.
A spare part. To this gifted master of the heart mechanism, the next step was logical.
We decided that we would try to use this vein as an artery. Instead of it being an exit for the blue blood to get out of the heart, we're going to try to convert it into an artery or a new entrance for blood getting into the heart.
Dr. Beck described the actual technique.
In order to do this, we have taken a piece of vein from the patient's elbow, about an inch long, and we've attached one end of this vein to the aorta, which carries red blood, and the other end to this large vein or spare part on the back of the heart.
This vein graft becomes an auxiliary pipeline for the heart.
In other words, a new avenue, independent of the blocked or clogged old arteries, for feeding in the red blood, the lifeblood which the heart requires. This is the Beck operation. Of course, the operation didn't spring full-blown and perfect from the surgeon's brain. Into it went years of study and preparation. Scores of times, hundreds of times, Dr. Beck performed it experimentally in the laboratory, and now and then he wrote a paper about his progress in the scientific journals. Then one day in December 1950...
I happened to pick up an article in the medical journal in which Dr. Bechtold of experimental work he was doing to find a satisfactory treatment for coronary disease.
That is the voice of Dr. R.D. Worden, a physician of Ravenna, Ohio. A man well qualified both personally and professionally to talk about this new weapon against the inroads of the killer.
In the early 40s, I had some symptoms of coronary disease, culminating in 1948 with a coronary thrombosis.
For 2 months, Dr. Worden was hospitalized, much of the time in oxygen. Eventually, in March of 1950, he was able to return to work.
However, I found that I was unable to do some of the simple little things that I had always considered essential, such as driving a car or working in the garden, little chores around the house. I had pain in my neck and my arms and a heart pain in my chest.
What about his mental attitude?
I knew that I might see a patient on a Monday and tell him to come back on Wednesday, and immediately into my mind would flash the thought, but will I be here on Wednesday?
It was at this point that Dr. Worden picked up that medical journal, and within a matter of minutes he was on his way to Cleveland and to the office of Dr. Beck. Here, as they recalled it for us in their own words, is the substance of their conversation when they first sat face to face back in December 1950.
Dr. Beck, I know that I have serious coronary disease, and so far as I've been able to determine, everything has been done medically that can be done. I've come to you because I want the operation.
Well, Dr. Worden, I don't think the work has developed far enough to consider you.
Then what else do you have to offer?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to answer.
What would you do if you were in my place?
Well, frankly, Dr. Worden, I think I would have the operation done.
That's exactly what I want.
Cornered then by his own logic, Dr. Beck consented to operate. On January the 12th, 1951, Dr. Worden went into surgery. The vein from his elbow, the vein at the back of the heart, were linked to make that auxiliary pipeline, that spare part, that new artery feeding red blood into the heart, substituting for the arteries blocked and ravaged by coronary disease. And the result?
When I wakened from the anesthetic, I had no pain in my chest and no pain in my neck or arms. All of the symptoms of coronary disease were gone.
A few days ago, he examined a small patient for glasses.
I told the mother to bring her daughter back in 24 years. The mother looked at me with a smile, and I laughed, too. I really think I'll be here.
At University Hospital, they kept careful watch on Dr. Worden and others who have had the operation since. And as Dr. B. L. Brofman, one of the cardiologists, described it to us...
Along with the physical improvement, these patients have an improved mental outlook and are no longer living in the fear of sudden death.
And Dr. Beck himself puts the operation into medical perspective like this.
It does not stop the progress of the disease, but red blood supplied by this new pipeline will protect the heart so that when an additional artery is blocked off, the patient has a considerably better chance of surviving from this additional heart attack.
Another ancient enemy which the scientist has under searching investigation today is high blood pressure and its resulting degeneration, hardening of the arteries.
When we became interested in hardening the arteries, we found that the medical profession and the lay people considered this disease inevitable. You couldn't do anything about it.
Gone then is the old despair. Dr. Lewis Katz was speaking. He's the president of the American Heart Association.
It was just a matter of aging, and as you got older, your arteries hardened. Well, we have found that this is not so, and so have other people working in this field. The slogan of the American Heart Association is correct when we say, yes, there is hope.
At Michael Reese Hospital, Chicago, Dr. Katz is himself engaged in important research, probing the conditions which seem to precede Arteriosclerosis.
It has been found that this disease is associated in man with conditions in which the blood fat content is high. We chose the chicken for a suitable animal because their arteries show the same kind of hardening that man did.
And again in this area of hypertension, we found in Cleveland dedicated men at work. In the 8-story building which houses the research division of the Cleveland Clinic Foundation, Dr. Irvin H. Page and his staff of 30 men and women have thrown off the old attitude of hopeless fatalism and with promising results, as Dr. Page himself told us.
Looking back over the 21 years, I feel that there has been a great deepening of the knowledge of the disease and that I can only view the future with really great optimism. There are enough leads to suggest that treatment can be vastly improved.
Dr. Page placed under 3 categories their efforts to nail down the cause of high blood pressure.
Chemical identification of a wide variety of substances that may be the cause, effort to produce the disease in animals, and then identify and recognize the mechanism, and then the experimental approach in patients themselves.
Dr. A.C. Corcoran of the clinic staff gave us the perspective from which they view their problem.
We departed long ago from the notion that the heart was the beginning and end of the circulation. It's actually more or less of a wide spot in the stream. You can't do without it, but you can't do without your blood vessels either.
In other words,
these diseases, high blood pressure and the hardening of the arteries, involve every blood vessel in the body.
And the approach to that task, therefore, is the approach of a team, a combat team, each man with his own assignment, but all aiming at the coordinated capture of a single objective. Dr. Corcoran named for us some of the members of the team.
The protein chemists, organic chemists, physiologists, and histologists.
And in one of the laboratories of the clinic, bending over a small cage, we found one member of the task force seeking the relationship between hypertension and a human ailment which, while rare, is tragic and terrible when it strikes. Toxemia of pregnancy.
Look at this cut 24 hours after the injection of renin.
This is Dr. Georges Masson.
His blood pressure is high. He's swollen. He presents some nervous symptoms, in some respects similar to those seen in toxemia of pregnancy, which is a cardiovascular disease, one of the diseases that we want to defeat in humans.
And because of the things Dr. Masson and men like him are learning, and through their correlation in a new body of knowledge, Dr. Harriet P. Dustin was able to tell us...
In the short 3.5 years that I have been here, things have changed considerably. During the first year, we had little to offer the patient with severe essential hypertension. Even some of those patients who previously would have died in a few weeks have now been returned to useful and productive activity.
Dr. Page listed for us the techniques for treating high blood pressure, the treatment depending, of course, on the diagnosis of the individual patient.
The operation of sympathectomy, cutting the sympathetic nerves as they course down along the spine, the drastic low-salt diet, the use of different drugs, only recently available. The pharmaceutical industry has a very large stake in this problem because drugs may replace more drastic treatments such as these extreme diets and major forms of surgery such as sympathectomy.
And if high blood pressure and its attendant ills don't eventually fall before the assault of science, it won't be for lack of well-planned effort. For as Dr. Page pointed out,
the National Heart Institute, the American Council for High Blood Pressure, which was started incidentally in Cleveland, and the American Society for the Study of Arteriosclerosis have all been organized, and they're all aiding immeasurably in the work.
In a spotless corridor of St. Vincent Charity Hospital in Cleveland, we talked to a boy named Jimmy.
I had my operation 11 days ago. I'm 15 years old. I'm in a 9-8. I had a tutor about a year ago. I was short of breath since 1948. My ankle used to be swollen at certain times. I haven't been able to run much.
Rheumatic fever, most pathetic of the 3 major causes of heart ailments, because it so often strikes the young. But remember our friend Jimmy just said...
I had my operation 11 days ago.
Yes. Here we learn of another new tool in the hands of the surgeon, and another reprieve from disability and early death.
We studied you just before Christmas, didn't we, Jim?
At our side stood Dr. Henry A. Zimmerman, who explained to us what it is that results from rheumatic fever that incapacitates, that cripples. It seems that in the heart there is a certain important valve called the mitral valve.
The normal mitral valve has a diameter, when open, something like that of a silver dollar.
But rheumatic fever constricts this valve, causes it to shrink.
Jim's mitral valve is the size of a nickel.
And Dr. Zimmerman knew this exactly to the fraction of a centimeter before Jim's operation. He used a new measurement device, which he described.
Intracardiac catheterization is nothing more than taking a small plastic tube, opening a vein in the arm, and then under the fluoroscope, as you can see here, we take and pass this tube up the arm, down into the heart, through the tricuspid valve, through the valve in the heart, and through the chamber up into the pulmonary artery, and even to where we can measure pressures out in a very, very small branch of that artery.
And by what formula do they discover that Jim's valve is no larger than a 5-cent piece?
We substitute data, which we get into formula, which the hydraulic engineer uses.
And the surgeon then, equipped with this information, at the moment which demands his most precise and delicate skill, knows exactly what he faces. The operation is a daring one, and recent. It was still in the experimental stage in 1949. Dr. Earl B. Kay, a Cleveland surgeon, told us how it's done.
In the operation devised by Dr. Charles Bailey, the finger is inserted into the heart. A specially designed guillotine knife is introduced along with the finger. The knife is approximately 6 inches in length and fits snugly into the palm of the hand. The heart valve is reopened so that blood can again flow from one chamber to the next, and the heart valve then acts essentially normally. When this is accomplished, the patient can resume normal activity. This is what happened in the case of Jimmy.
That's why there's a boy in Cleveland today who was able to tell us.
Well, I'm going to be glad when I go back to school. Now I can go out for baseball. That's what I like most. I'd like to try to play some football, too. Feel fine.
Rheumatic blessing that it is, this operation for rheumatic heart is a corrective. Prevention would be better still. And here, too, Cleveland has its pioneer, Dr. Charles H. Rammelkamp. He told us,
an attempt has been made during the past 3 years through a cooperative effort between the Air Force, the Army, and Western Reserve University to prevent acute rheumatic fever.
To prevent, one must first know the cause.
Rheumatic fever follows or is precipitated by an acute streptococcal infection of the throat.
In fact, it was found by Dr. Rammelkamp and his colleagues,
approximately 3% of all individuals with a so-called strep sore throat will develop acute rheumatic fever within 3 weeks.
And in extensive clinical tests conducted over a 3-year period in Wyoming, the investigators have found
use of either oreomycin or penicillin in proper dosage will prevent 60% of the cases of acute rheumatic fever.
And the hope?
Basically, our hope is to prevent 100% of all infections, and it is believed only by eventual control of the streptococcal sore throat itself can we prevent all acute rheumatic fever.
So we've heard them and watched them as they deploy in many-pronged attack. The doctors, the surgeons, the clinicians, the medical social workers, fighting heart disease in the city on Lake Erie. We recorded that sound at Cleveland City Hospital in the laboratory of Dr. George H. H. Clues, Jr.
This is an artificial heart and lung, which is now taking the place of the animal's heart and lung in the maintenance of life.
Dr. Clues described how it works.
Blood passes from the veins to the oxygenating device in the lower left-hand corner. Here, oxygen is restored to the venous blood, as would be done in the animal's own lung. It then passes to the pump, which returns the blood under pressure to the animal's arterial system.
By this apparatus, men like Dr. Clues are able to keep heart and brain and lung alive for hours rather than minutes, while the heart itself lies open and exposed before their searching gaze. But just what, we asked him, do you hope to accomplish?
By opening the heart, we are able to create abnormalities similar to those that exist within the human heart. This enables us to simulate the situation that takes place in the blue baby or in the patient with mitral stenosis. And by studying these things, we hope to learn a little bit more about these diseases on the human.
And he added, there's a long-range goal, a challenging goal as well.
We hope that by this means we may be able someday to actually open the heart and correct these abnormalities under direct vision.
Under direct vision. Not yet, but someday. The constant goading incentive of the restless, searching mind. Not yet, but someday. It's the drive you find wherever doctors are working on problems of the heart, not only in Cleveland, but in every part of the nation as well. The men who are penetrating the mysteries of that organ, of which there is only one to a customer, the human heart. The pioneers thrusting forward on the endless frontier.
Only One to a Customer was the fourth in a series of documentaries on medical research brought to you by Health Information Foundation and the National Broadcasting Company. The heart wants to beat, said one of the surgeons in today's story. And from this natural drive toward self-preservation, scientists take their cue. Through dramatic techniques of surgery, through the use of drugs, through the principles of nutrition and other means, science is working with the heart in the battle against its mortal enemy, disease. You can help, too, by checking with your doctor regularly, by watching your weight, by careful diet, by avoiding overexercise. Heart disease may never be your problem if you take the necessary precautions today. The Endless Frontier comes to you as a presentation of Health Information Foundation, a nonprofit organization established by the drug, pharmaceutical, and allied industries to gather and distribute basic information about health needs, progress, and services. Part of the purpose of Health Information Foundation is to report how Americans are working to improve their own health facilities in the communities in which they live. A booklet describing five such community action programs may now be obtained by writing Booklet, Post Office Box 67, New York 17, New York. We repeat, Booklet, Post Office Box 67, New York 17, New York. The Endless Frontier, transcribed, with Raymond Massey, is produced by Wade Arnold and directed by Fred Way. Today's script was by Wade Arnold and Ann Miller. Next week, direct from the Korean battlefront, comes an exciting report of how the armed forces in Korea are medically safeguarding our troops, and how these medical advances may soon spell better health for us at home on the Endless Frontier.
This is Jerry Hendigus.